I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. So how do you define fatherhood? If a child is conceived using frozen sperm after the death of the father, is the father still a father by any measure beyond the obvious biological connection? I mean, look at it this way. A number of young soldiers had their sperm frozen before being sent overseas in case they were killed in action. That would mean any child born of that sperm would then have a mother, but only a photograph of someone called dad. Oh, no, 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 you say. Don't be so legalistic. Of course he's the father. What else? Who else would he be? Well, okay. Take the next step. Is that child then eligible for the father's inheritance, survivor benefits like Social Security? Or should a man have to prove his intent to father a child after death? Or is leaving the sperm proof enough? Try this on. What would, or would that mean, rather, that the mother would have to be someone who was married to that man at the time when the sperm was frozen? Or does the fatherhood then live on indefinitely in that frozen sperm? These are complicated questions. We'll be exploring them this hour, and we'd like to have your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start the program today with a woman who has lived with these questions for the past 8 years. Rhonda Gillette Netting is the mother of twins who were conceived 10 months after her husband's death from cancer. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has recently ruled that her twins are entitled to Social Security benefits. And Rhonda's joining us from the studios of KUAT in Tucson, Arizona. Rhonda, thanks for being with us.
Oh, good morning.
And congratulations on winning the court case. It was a long, long wait.
Yes, and there's always that chance of appeal still for a few more days.
I guess. Okay. The twins now, are they probably close to their eighth birthday now?
Yes, a couple more weeks and they'll be eight.
Let's talk about the story. Let's go back those 8 years. Your husband, Robert, died before the twins were even conceived. How did that happen?
Well, when Bob and I got married in 1993, we had been together for 4 years, and what had really been holding us up was the decision about children. So once we sorted that out, we got married, and we immediately started to have a family. And in 1994, we were living in Bloomington, Indiana. And at that point, I'd had several miscarriages. So I had consulted my OBGYN and had gone on Clomid therapy to help me ovulate more regularly. And that's when we received the cancer diagnosis in December of 1994. And at that point, we were told it was a fairly aggressive cancer. It was called multiple myeloma. And so we immediately returned to Tucson to go to the cancer center here at the University Medical Center. And when Bob arrived, because I had to send him on ahead of me, mm-hmm. He chose to delay treatment for 3 days so that he could begin storing sperm for me. And when I came out here a few days later, he began his treatment and things were progressing just fine. And I attended the first doctor's appointment in January of 1995 to actually begin the intrauterine insemination process from this stored sperm. And at that point, that's when Bob and I had our first real discussion about whether or not I should continue this if he were to die. And in that discussion, he said, you know, he asked me whether or not I wanted to do that. And I said, yes. And I said, how do you feel? And we discussed that. And he was very happy for me to continue with it. And unfortunately, before that first appointment in February, he did die of cancer. And so I went ahead with the insemination later that month and was not successful and went through several other tries that year. And it was December before I was actually successful with using in vitro.
When you go back to the conversation that you were having with Bob, was there ever the thought from you or from Bob, no, don't continue in case I die? This would be Bob talking. You know, go ahead, find someone else and have a family with that person.
No, there was never that to the conversation, and there was never that question in my mind. I had always wanted children, and I particularly wanted children with him, and it just seemed the right thing to do.
You hit your first roadblock when the twins were born, and you had to fill out the birth certificate.
Yes, I did. They were born in North Carolina, where I had gone to complete a postdoctorate research position. And at that point, they wouldn't put his name on the birth certificate because he wasn't there to verify that he was the father. And so I had to get letters faxed from the reproductive endocrinology unit here in Tucson to basically verify that he was indeed the genetic father of the children.
And yeah. then to Social Security for benefits for the twins, and they too said no. What was their explanation, Rhonda?
As I recall, their first reason for turning it down was that it wasn't clear that he had intended for me to have his children after he died. And so what you do after you get the first turn down is you ask for a reconsideration. Right. And in the reconsideration, I gave them the information they needed to show that he had intended for me to do this.
Was that something that you and Robert had put in writing?
It wasn't in writing directly, as in I intend for you to use this posthumously, but right. in the storage of the sperm, the counseling process that he underwent, that was part of the discussion. And the understanding was that you're terminally ill, and unless you don't want it used, mm-hmm. Your wife may use this. They've since changed that consent form to very specifically consent to posthumous conception.
And Rhonda, your application for the benefits from Social Security, was that a straight ahead, hey, we need the money, or was there a little bit of, you know, I want to make sure that the state recognizes that these are not only my children, but Bob's as well?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both of that. I definitely financially could have used the money then. But part of it was, yes, you know, these were his children and he had paid into Social Security insurance. And so I felt that as his children, they should receive his benefits.
But it took you years of fighting in court for one level of court to say, yes, finally, they do deserve those benefits, right?
Right. And that was the Ninth Circuit earlier this year.
Can you think of a set of circumstances, Rhonda, where maybe it would have been harder to make that case if you didn't have that prior agreement with Bob or something like, you know, I mean, it seems like every single one of these cases turns so carefully on the specific facts. Can you make blanket rules that posthumous conception automatically means that the children deserve those kinds of benefits? Have you thought in sort of in broader terms about that?
Well, there is quite a bit of debate about that. I think that in the Ninth Circuit ruling, though, what they said was that a natural child, and it, in court it's been demonstrated that in vitro children are natural children,
right.
And legitimate children. And in Arizona, we don't have such category as illegitimate children, so all children are legitimate. The Ninth Circuit Court said that a natural legitimate child under the Social Security Act is presumed to be dependent upon the father, and you need no other demonstration. And that's what they ruled. But yes, I could think of several ways that people are approaching this topic to sort of set time limits or specifications as to consent and that kind of thing.
Well, Rhonda, just hang on, if you would, for a couple of moments. I want to bring my other guest into the program, Elizabeth Bartlett. We're here with me in the Boston studio. She's a professor at Harvard Law School and author of Family Bonds, Adoption, Infertility, and the New World of Child Production. Elizabeth, nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
When you listen to Rhonda telling her story about those specific circumstances, I can imagine you thinking to yourself, wow, do you decide it just on those, or can you make rules that would apply to everyone in all these different cases? It becomes quite complicated.
Yeah, I actually don't pose that as a question. I think very much as a society, we ought to be systematically thinking about the rules to apply in this and a whole lot of the situations that arise involving new reproductive technologies. So while I think Rhonda's case is an enormously sympathetic case as it comes to the court, and it certainly makes sense given that those kids are there for Social Security benefits to be available, I think it's an example of how our society is backing into policymaking with the courts doing it to the degree we're doing it, and the courts really not being in a position to make appropriate policy.
So yes, is it the legislators who are dropping the ball in that case then?
Well, if we look at the experience of every single other country in our advanced technological situation,
right.
Every other country has had a national body, a national commission of some kind, to look at the huge range of policy issues involved not only in posthumous conception, but also cloning, eugenics, sex selection, all the risks that IVF poses to women and children, huge range of ethical and social policy issues. And in every other country, they've basically tried to put all or all the issues they can think of that are arising in this new world of reproduction on the table, and then sort out what, as a society, they want to do with those issues. And they've tried to have on the commission, in the room, looking at these issues on the table, the variety of groups whose interests are affected. In other words, disability groups, women's groups, groups that represent the interests of children. And then those national commissions have recommended national legislation governing some issues, have recommended some kind of agency to monitor developments in the field for others.
But so sooner or later, it's the legislators who then have to sit down and do it,
right,
not the people who are accused of being activist judges.
Right. But the difference here, for example, I mean, on the posthumous conception issue,
right,
what often happens here is we get a case, falls into the laps of the courts, they do something, then either state legislatures do or don't step in. And here in California, as I understand it, you may have some legislation related to this very specific issue.
Right.
But that's the problem. We can't approach these issues in that kind of very narrow specific ways. For example, Rhonda's case raises a variety of issues. Let's take single parenting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a single adoptive parent and single parent by birth myself, and I'm a believer in it. But the fact is, in the area of posthumous conception, as a society, we're allowing / encouraging single parenting. If you look at the world of adoption, we are discouraging single parenting. Single parents are at the bottom of the potential parent hierarchy. If you look at Rhonda's case, it involves in vitro fertilization. Other societies are worried about and taking action to address the health and safety issues for women and children that IVF presents. Now, again, I would not cut off IVF.
Mm-hmm.
I went through IVF myself. I do believe that there are very serious risks for women and children's health that we need as a society to systematically approach.
But are you saying that one regulatory board should be making those decisions for Rhonda and for everyone who has their own different set of circumstances?
Well, there's certainly a major issue for our society. I mean, there's a reason, obviously, that our society stands out as the only one that hasn't taken this systematic regulatory approach.
Sure, there's a constitution.
There's a constitution.
Belief in individual rights.
Powerful belief in individual autonomy and in procreative freedom. So we need, as a society, to face up to whether that means that we should or should not be systematically regulating. There are going to be costs if we go the systematic regulation route.
Mm-hmm.
There are risks. I mean, I'm a believer in abortion rights. There are risks that abortion freedom would be more constricted if we went the regulatory approach. Myself, I think the policy issues are so important that we can't afford not to. For example, eugenics is clearly already happening, but the potential for more systematic eugenics by doctors and their patients with the use of IVF, the ability to examine genetically these embryos in the dish and decide which ones to use, poses, you know, enormous dangers, I think, to our society.
This is, though, being done on a state-to-state basis in the absence of any of the sort of broader look that Elizabeth is describing. When we come back after the break, we'll be talking with State Assemblyman Tom Harmon, who is a Republican representative from Huntington Beach, California, and saw through a piece of legislation, California's attempt to address this issue of posthumous conception. We'd like to hear from you on the program as well. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The words posthumous conception aren't words that we often hear at the coffee table conversation, but we may be hearing them a little bit more often as we understand that there are some difficult moral, ethical, and legal questions tied up in defining the fatherhood of children if that child is born with the use of frozen sperm after the death of the father. It raises personal questions like inheritance, but also state questions like benefits, Social Security, that sort of thing. We'd love to have you in on our conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I want to bring in State Assemblyman Tom Harmon. As I said, he is a Republican representative from Huntington Beach, California, and wrote a bill that would grant children conceived posthumously to have inheritance right, at least rights to the dead father's estate. And Tom, it's good of you to be with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dick. Glad to be here.
What was it that got you interested in this whole thing in the first place?
Well, I'm an attorney. Before I became a legislator, I practiced law for about 30 years and did a lot of probate and estate planning work like that. And I think I read a law review article or something like that, perhaps something in the paper, but somehow along the line I got kind of interested in the topic.
Now, people I hear referring to your bill as a dead dad's bill. Is that a fair way of referring to it?
Well, I'm not sure it's fair, but it has been called that in the slang terminology. But it's an important issue, just as the professor mentioned a few minutes ago. I think it is an important issue that society needs to address, and the courts are more or less crying out for some direction from the legislatures to around the country to set policy on this issue.
Now, you looked at the question of the rights of a posthumously conceived child to a father's inheritance. How did you get at that? Is there a simple way of describing it?
Well, I think there probably is. We started out by saying that if the child is conceived within a two-year period, 2 years subsequent, more or less, to the death of the father, and then there's a requirement that the decedent must have designated in writing, and that's an important distinction.
That's the father we're talking about,
yes.
Is the decedent, yeah.
The one that donates the genetic material must indicate in writing that he or she wants the material to be used for posthumous conception, and then there's a notice requirement that within 4 months of the death of the donor, whoever is going to make a claim on the estate must give notice to the party that's holding assets of the estate. Now, that could be an insurance company. It could be an executor of a probate estate. It could be a trustee of a trust, and they have to give notice that they're holding the material and that they may intend to use it. And then that triggers this two-year moratorium, so distribution can't be made.
And why the time limits? Why was that an important part of it, to say, you know, within 2 years or the law doesn't apply?
Sure. Well, there's a corresponding interest in society in general to provide for the timely distribution of a decedent's estate. You don't want it tied up in probate for years and years and years, or held by an insurance company or a trust for many, many years. So we talked about that. I had set up a working group here in California and discussed what would be a reasonable period of time, and we came up with 2 years.
I want to, if I just, without letting you go, Assemblyman, bring Rhonda Gillette-Netting back in on the question of time limits. Rhonda, is there any of Bob's sperm still frozen in the lab?
Yes.
And could you, would you, have you thought about perhaps having other children using that?
Actually, yeah, I did think, you know, about that possibility, but I never was thinking that I would do that. I primarily have hung on to it in case there was ever any question for genetic testing, but we've gone beyond that now in the courts.
I'm just curious to know, as someone who has been through this firsthand, what you think of the idea of a time limit, whether or not that makes sense to you.
You know, for myself, that does. It seems that a reasonable period of time would be fine. The lawyers aren't going to be happy that I said that, but because the legal side of it, of course, that, you know,
they're trying to make the case
very differently
at any time under any circumstances, right?
Yes, I think so. And but I think that it's reasonable to have some kind of general time limit on it, particularly if we're going to try to have legislation that makes this clear.
And Elizabeth Bartlett, is this getting in some way towards a definition of when and how rights should operate under posthumous conception?
Yes and no. I think it shows that the legislatures can do a better job than the courts. They can think about things like, should we require that the man's intent to procreate posthumously be in writing, an important requirement, I think. But I think this also illustrates how the legislatures typically today in America are approaching just the tiniest of the issues. I mean, so for example, there was a case a few years ago about grandparents who seized their only dead son's body and had the doctor extract sperm from it so that they could have the sperm put into a surrogate so that they, the grandparents, didn't have to die without having any grandchildren on this earth. Now, you know, this legislation, understandably, in California doesn't address that issue, but there is an issue in some cases as to whether posthumous procreation is going to be a good thing for kids. Mm-hmm. And we need somebody, thinking about the issue of whether grandparents are entitled to have children brought into this earth who will have no parents, who will have grandparents for a limited number of years, who will then be assigned to new parents. Is that a good idea in social policy terms?
And Tom Harmon, I know there have been cases when the wives of husbands killed in a car accident have done the same thing, seen to it that some sperm was extracted. If that were to happen in California, would the children born of that sperm qualify for the inheritance, the same standing under your bill as you know, the case where a father wrote out consent in advance?
Well, I don't think they would. If you're saying that the father died in a car accident, and if you are assuming that he had not designated in writing,
right, that's what I'm assuming.
So the answer to the question is no. Under those circumstances, the bill would not apply to any children that were born using that process.
And does it stand to be even messier as people come up with different ways of looking at it? I mean, it's not uncommon now for a father to have two, maybe even three generations of children. So if an elderly man with a very young wife is to die and leave sperm frozen with his written consent, couldn't that tie up inheritance for potentially another 20, 30 years?
Well, under my bill, it would not because of the two-year limitation. In other words, genetic material must be used within 2 years or else it's barred, and there could be future-born children, but they would not be able to inherit under the California proposal.
And that's part of the scenario, or that sort of imagining these scenarios was part of the time limit?
Yes, indeed, it was.
Assemblyman, I want to thank you for being with us. It's interesting to hear you explain what you're up to there.
You're sure welcome. My pleasure.
Tom Harmon, Republican Representative, Huntington Beach, California, authored a bill granting children conceived posthumously inheritance rights under certain circumstances. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're taking our first call from Basking Ridge, New Jersey. Karen is with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I find this so incredibly interesting because I'm living this situation right now. My husband died of esophageal cancer, or at least fought the battle for the past 2.5 years, 3 years. Mm. And when he was sick, we had talked at length about our future and the dream of having a family. And I already had one child, but we were conscious that we may, you know, that if I did lose my husband, my child would not have a brother or a sister or possibly not a dad. And so we had made arrangements ahead of time, included it in his will and even in my will, and since he passed away in March of 2002, I did conceive and had twins. And so, you know, it's, you know, an ongoing case right now where, you know, about should they receive the rights, but it's something that, you know, we had talked about when he was alive. He had agreed to it and wanted to give me the gift, and I, you know.
And you listened to Rhonda tell us a very similar story. When you look at the future of the twins now, mm-hmm. What are they, a year and a half?
No, they're just almost 10 months old right now.
Okay. Do they end up with the same inheritance rights as the child born when your husband was still alive? How is that working out in New Jersey?
Well, it's currently they were denied the Social Security rights. Although the Social Security representative told me clearly that I should appeal it. And my brother, Bob Kuttner, is an attorney, as is my dad, and they are basically, you know, following what's been happening in the world right now and following what's just transpired in California, for example, and hoping that that will then take place in New Jersey as well. But currently it does not exist in New Jersey.
Karen, I want to ask you if you can just hang on. Rhonda, of course, is still with us, and Elizabeth is here in the studio. I want to bring Chris from Canton, Massachusetts, into the conversation. Chris has been holding on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Dick, how are you?
I'm fine. You don't like the idea of people conceiving posthumously, is that right?
Not in the least. Only from the point of view of expecting the taxpayer to pick up the bill. I just simply don't see where individual's desire to either cheat death by leaving children behind,
right,
or in a world full of children who need to be adopted and don't have homes, in a world where we don't have sufficient health care, I think it's very selfish, arrogant, and typically American to expect to get the government to pay for you to have children after your husband's dead. It's just
okay, let's take this one at a time. Are you saying that everyone has the right to have the children in the way that Karen and Rhonda did, but not to then expect government benefits.
Exactly. I'm not about to tell you what to do with your sperm and eggs, and I don't think it's the government's place to do that either. But what I am saying is that if you want to have a child with your dead husband, you should be able to pay for it and handle the economic aspects of that yourself and not expect me to do it. Very simple.
Rhonda, you've faced these tough questions over the last few years. What's your answer to Chris?
Well, essentially, Social Security is an insurance policy that my husband did pay into fully, and so those are insurance benefits, much the same as his life insurance policy was an insurance policy. So I think that they do have the right to benefit from the money he paid into an insurance policy.
Yes, but these are survivor benefits we're talking about, right? From Social Security for his dependent children who are supposedly alive now that he's dead. Am I understanding this correctly?
Right, and they do survive. They're alive.
Yeah, but they weren't alive when he died. That's the crux of the matter. You made a conscious choice to take those sperm that were frozen, implant them in your body, have children. Why do you expect me to pay for that?
I don't expect you to pay for it. My husband's insurance with Social Security.
No, your husband's Social Security insurance is being paid for out of public funds that I contribute to from the taxes that I pay. I am paying for it. I'm paying for your choice to have a child with you. If you wanted to do this and didn't want public funds, I'd be behind you 100%. Believe me, I'm not some kind of, you know, conservative maniac. I'm a left winger. I'm a liberal. But this just seems so absurd to me.
Chris, hang on a second. Let's let Karen in here, because Karen is living the same set of circumstances in New Jersey. Karen, how do you answer what Chris is saying?
You know, I think it's one thing if somebody didn't have a decision. You know, I spent years of fighting a battle with cancer where my husband was fully aware that this was what we were hoping to do, and it was a life decision that we were making together with the clear understanding that, you know, we both didn't want my son to live without a father or a brother or a sister and live a lonely life. And I think it was a conscious decision that we made together and he made while he was alive.
But Karen, what about Chris's point that all of that is as it should be, that those are all your choices, but then when it comes to benefits from the government, he's got an interest in weighing in here?
Yeah, but you know what? I hear what you're saying, Chris, but I do think that when it comes down to the fact that this is coming, I agree with Rhonda. I mean, it comes specifically from what my husband earned for working most of his life. And it's coming right from that, not from Chris. He's not personally paying for it. It's coming from what was earned and what right he has.
So based on your logic, then, I'm to expect that you could keep having children for the next 100 years off of his sperm.
No.
Yes, that's exactly what you're saying.
In keeping very clearly with, you know, with the, not only with the representative from California said that he, you know, it had to be something that was done within a 2-year period. I mean, I was doing it specifically with my husband for that period of time. Definitely not expecting that this is a lifelong situation.
Okay, time for a little bit of a breath on those different sides. Elizabeth Bartlett, you've been listening in on this debate. It really does cut in many ways to our own, to the different senses of who's right here.
Well, I guess what strikes me is how differently the issues would look if we were doing rational, systematic policymaking. Okay, so 3 points I want to make quickly. One is, Chris's viewpoint would at least get listened to. He and people like him could testify. In court, they're really not heard, because the sympathy when a court is sitting there with 2-year-old or 4-year-old twins and saying, shall we help get these kids supported or not? The range of viewpoints is not heard. The cost to society, if they're relevant, aren't being counted.
Right.
Even Chris indicated, well, he wouldn't want to stop anybody from producing these kids. The only question is support. And I differ with that. Social policymakers would think, in my grandparent case, for example, which has already happened, maybe we should not allow the doctor to serve the wishes of those grandparents who want the ego satisfaction of grandkids on this earth before they die.
But it's more complicated than ego satisfaction in the case of Rhonda and Karen.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's, you know, the issue of inheritance is tiny, and we are not deciding these other cases. We are allowing, whether there's a California bill about inheritance or not,
right,
we're allowing those grandparents to go ahead and procreate when perhaps somebody should be stopping them. Third point I want to make is, it may or may not be in Karen and Rhonda's genuine best interest to have created these kids, and I'm not going to comment on that. But I do think when you raised the larger issue you mentioned, and it's true, soldiers now are going off to war, leaving their sperm so that their wives, in case of the soldier's death, can create their kids. I think they're very real issues as to whether we should be encouraging women to produce after the death of their children, or whether we should be discouraging them. At a minimum, it seems to me rational social policymakers looking at this whole picture might well say we should mandate counseling for women before they're allowed to do this, counseling that would make them think both about their own interests and about future children's interests, whether both the women and the children will be better off encouraged in the old-fashioned way to go out and find a new mate and produce new families that
Karen,
way.
Karen, what do you think about that, if you had been told that you had to have counseling before you went ahead with this?
You know what, I mean, I think that I'm a very sane, rational woman, and I've made a very clear, conscious decision to do this. You know, anytime you go into a decision of going to an infertility clinic, there's a certain amount of counseling that takes place.
Right.
But it's a choice that you make. And, you know, the idea of waiting to find a husband to do it more traditionally sounds tremendous if you're 25 years old. But if you're in your 30s, your late 30s, you know, you're putting a heck of a lot of pressure on a relationship when you had you had arrangements, you had a dream. Unfortunately, you know, with the likes of cancer and with war and other things that we're all facing, that's not always possible to live out. And I look at Katie Couric's decision when she put it on the air to tell all, I don't know if you all heard this, but she made an announcement and told people that were going off to war that she recommended they go to sperm banks to do just this. So, I mean, I think I'm not the only person that's moved in this direction. I think a lot of people would be thinking about that.
All right. Karen, I'm going to have to stop you because we're taking a break here. I thank you for joining the conversation. And put it back to our listeners as well. When you look at some of the issues being raised by this specific question of posthumous conception, does it raise larger questions about whether or not the courts are the ones making the decisions about what's happening with the latest in reproductive technology, whether or not the legislators are keeping track, and whether or not there ought to be a larger ethical body looking at some of the bigger questions. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about posthumous conception, and we have with us on the program here in the Boston studio, Elizabeth Bartlett. She's a professor at Harvard Law School and author of a book called Family Bonds, Adoption, Infertility, and the New World of Child Production. And Rhonda Gillette Netting is also with us. She is the mother of twins conceived 10 months after her husband's death from cancer. Rhonda is a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. And I have to tell you, Rhonda, as I was thinking about this program, what I kept doing was coming up with different scenarios and what ifs. I don't know, in the absence of the laws in many states, whether or not it's a sort of game that you find other people playing. But help me with one, if you will, and that's the imagined case of a young soldier who, you know, anticipating that something might go wrong when he goes off to war in Iraq, has some of his sperm frozen, and he is killed. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my gosh. And so his young wife, maybe she's 20, 21, 22 years old, gets the news that her husband has died and then has to deal with the pressure, because there could be pressure, from the husband's family saying, well, you are going to use that sperm. You are going to, you know, have his child. You are going to demonstrate your love that way. And I thought, boy, does she need, you know, a piece of legislation that gives her the opportunity to push back against that pressure, because it would come at such an emotional time. Well, help me with that, Rhonda.
Well, actually, you know, having spoken to a number of women going through this sort of process, what I found is that, in fact, families do just the opposite. They encourage that you take some time and grieve and wait and think about the decision. And for the people I know, I'm talking about four of us, the families have been very supportive of the idea, but have been looking out for the woman herself first. And so I think that while you might have an occasional case of a family trying to pressure a a young widow, basically, into mm-hmm. going ahead with this, I think that it's more likely to be the opposite, where they're actually discouraging or at least cautioning some time before they make that kind of decision.
But what about the suggestion that it is, in fact, more about you or your interests as a woman or as a mother than it might be about the interests of the twins themselves? When somebody says, you're going into single parenthood knowingly, are you really thinking about what's best for them?
Well, I think, though, that all of us, when we do this, and I speak very clearly for myself, yeah. we're thought about this a lot, and we're very clear that I wanted children. And that even if their father wasn't here, that I could still be a good parent and give them the kind of upbringing that would make them nice, healthy, good individuals in society. And the joy you get from children and just constantly seeing the mannerisms and the parts of your husband in them is just, it's a constant sort of living memory and reward after such a loss.
And so, Elizabeth, when you say that someone perhaps ought not to go into that without some counseling beforehand, what's the difference in your case? You became a single mom through adoption, right?
Yes.
So why wouldn't you have to go through the same sort of counseling, for example, Elizabeth?
Oh, believe me, to become an adoptive parent, you have to go through a lot of counseling and in my view, an undue amount of negative regulatory bureaucracy.
But aren't you asking for the same negative regulatory bureaucracy in the case of people like Rhonda?
What I'm asking for is an evening up of how we treat reproduction on the one hand and adoption on the other. And so what I'm concerned with, or one of the things I'm concerned with, and one of the things that could be addressed if we had systematic policymaking, is the way in which we apply sort of individual autonomy, free market rules to the procreation area, including posthumous procreation, mm-hmm. Whereas we apply a very negative, restrictive regulatory apparatus to the adoption realm. Now, this to me is completely lunatic. If anything, I think we should be encouraging people to become parents of kids who already exist and need homes. And if anything, somewhat discouraging them from creating new kids when there are already so many kids who need homes. At a minimum, we ought to treat these two forms of parenting more equal-handedly. You know, therefore, one of the many good things I think that mandatory counseling could do would be to at least alert people thinking about becoming parents to some of the adoption options and to get them to think a little harder maybe about benefits and costs to children of both the ones who exist and need homes and also the ones who don't yet exist and might be brought into the world.
Rhonda, let me make this personal for you. I mean, if someone were to say, hey, you should be adopting children, not using that frozen sperm. I mean, you spoke a couple of moments ago about the joy that you get in seeing those elements of your former husband Bob's character in the children themselves. But what about the adoption argument?
For myself, adoption wasn't something I wanted. If the insemination process hadn't worked, then that is something I would have considered down the line. But it was certainly something that was brought up in the fertility clinics. That's something they give you access to information on as part of sort of the range of your choices. What I'm concerned about, though, is if we regulate posthumous conception or artificial conception and regulate mandatory counseling for adoptive parents and assistive technology parents, right, why aren't we then insisting on it for all parents?
I'll go along with that. I love the example that people give me that, you know, you need a license to drive a car, but you don't to have children. I think that it's a reasonable way of coming back on that. Let's take a call from Boston. Jack's on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I was calling because I believe there's a case that's winding its way through the New York courts, and it involves a probate issue where there was a marriage with fertility treatment. The embryos went to the husband when that marriage was ended in divorce. He remarried, and on his death, the embryos went to the second wife. And the estate plan calls for income to the second wife, then to the children. And, I, you know, there's bad blood between the children of the first marriage and the second wife, and there's now this issue, well, if she uses these embryos to impregnate herself, will they be, you know, his children?
Oh, man, I'm getting lost here. What's the point of this one, Jack, that it's impossible in your view or a nightmare to try and trace genetic or biological parenthood through these kinds of...
Well, it's not that. I mean, you could make the argument that the wife in this case is attempting to, you know, partially disinherit the existing children by having, you know, her children, which are genetically siblings of the children from the first marriage. And you know, I guess I would say that, although I believe, you know, that women, you know, should be free, there's got to be some limits as to, you know, time and scope, you know, involving when a marriage ends, you know, over what happens to the either frozen sperm or frozen embryos.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, here we are in a world where through technology you can not only choose the sex of your child, but have a pretty good opportunity to choose the time of the birth and you know, at some point maybe even height and hair color and color of eye. I mean, so what do we do? Do we draw a line and say we've got to stick with things the way they are, or are you in sync with Elizabeth here that we need to have some body, some regulatory body saying, whoa, time to stop, think it all through?
Yeah, I mean, because you can conceivably have these fights that, you know, just go on forever. You know, I do some estate planning as an attorney, and, you know, people, you know, as the New York case illustrates, you can have people setting up what's a reasonable estate plan, and then all of a sudden there's going to be this huge fight, and I don't think that's going to be good for anybody, you know, the result of that case.
I just want to comment on that. I think the courts are going to solve this problem. There have been several of these embryo battle cases. But again, what they point up to me is how irrationally we're making policy. I mean, we can figure out who to give the embryos to, whether or not to let the man or the woman create new lives. If you look at what other countries are doing, they're saying we've got major problems because IVF is producing large number of multiples, twins, triplets, quadruplets, and these are typically unhealthy babies, certainly when it's triplets or more. And we should regulate to tell doctors how not to produce so many dangerous multiple pregnancies. Now, that's the kind of regulation the courts are unable to think about because it is not being presented to them. And those are the issues that we ought to be focusing on in this society. We can solve the relatively simple problem of whether or not you give that man those embryos to give to his second wife so she can reproduce.
To Brockton, Massachusetts, Bev's joining us on the line. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I apologize in advance for having a rather emotional reaction to this. It's certainly not one that's coming from my head, but I have a visceral reaction to this, which is please just do not regulate this and allow these women to make choices to have their babies. I am 49 years old, and 9 years ago, my very dear friend's husband was killed by a drunk driver, and she did not have children. She was in the process of going through fertility treatment, and she ultimately made the choice against it because the first time she walked into the clinic, it was nothing but legal hurdles that she knew she was going to have to get through. And I, on my own right now, as a married woman, could have 10 children if I wanted. And I just feel very, very strongly that we should not be anywhere near close to telling women posthumously that they are not allowed to use their husband's sperm to have children or not.
So you're disagreeing with Elizabeth, who says we need to have some rules in place?
You know, I can't say from a legal perspective that I would say that.
No, go ahead and argue it from a human perspective. None of us are lawyers here.
From a human perspective, I don't think we should have some rules. And I can't talk about – I listened earlier to the issue of the grandparents. I can't speak to that. I'm only speaking in a very narrow way about a woman whose husband – has died, and she has the right, like every other woman has, who has the right to go out and have children, and she just should have that right to do it. I could have a child with another man, and no one would be in my way.
I get that, but let's hear from Elizabeth here, because the regulatory body that you're talking about, in most cases, doesn't have that kind of flexibility to say, but this case is different, or these circumstances are different.
Well, I want to talk about the difference between true and illusory choice, and I think the regulatory body could facilitate true choice. So, speaking again from my own experience, at the age of over 40, I pursued in vitro fertilization a couple of decades ago, and I felt at the time I was experiencing extraordinary free choice. Now, the truth is, because there was no adequate counseling at the time, nor do I think there is today, being given out by the IVF clinics, I had approximately a zero chance of conceiving. So I went through IVF three times with a zero chance of conceiving, thinking of myself as having choice. Now, the other reason I think now that
But you're saying that you shouldn't have had that choice.
I should have been educated by counseling. And the second thing that the kind of counseling I'm after could provide is counseling about adoption. Rhonda, who said, well, she wasn't interested in adoption. Well, neither was I for 10 years, because I was socialized by our society to think that that's a last resort choice. I have now one child by birth, my first, and two by adoption. And I think if people knew about adoption, they would experience it as a full-fledged, first-choice form of parenting. And that's a piece of why I think that if we had counseling, which I do think should be mandated, we'd have something much closer to true choice.
But I hear Rhonda in the background saying, my children, no less my children, given the circumstances. Fair enough, Rhonda?
Yes.
It is a very complicated issue. And I want to thank you, Rhonda, for coming in to help us with your perspective.
Oh, you're welcome, Dick. Thank you.
Rhonda Gillette Netting is a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. Elizabeth Bartlett, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Elizabeth is a Harvard Law School professor. And earlier in the program, we talked with Assemblyman Tom Harmon from Huntington Beach, California, about legislation that is being passed in that state. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.